welcome back. Welcome back for the final session of this conference. Before we start, I've got two things to mention to you. One is a pink phone, and one is a tablet in a spotted case. Both apparently were left in room two. If they're yours, go and see them at the registration desk. If they're not yours, don't. Right, our final session, as you can see, is entitled Closing the Gap, Reducing Inequalities. And almost from the start of this conference, the word inequality, I think, has brooded over us, from Richard Wilkinson's excellent presentation to the stories and indeed the evidence that we've heard from around the world. And it is the gap we strive to close, but as we meet, as you know, it's a gap that is widening. A crisis that is deepening. Rough sleeping in England has doubled in 5 years. Thousands of people experiencing life on the streets every night now. And the housing crisis has seen a troubling increase in the numbers of families forced into temporary accommodation, including bed and breakfast. The latest figures suggest there are 1,000 families with children who've been stuck in B&B for more than 6 weeks. And if I tell you that the equivalent figure in 2004 was just 30 families, you can see how serious the problem has become. There's clearly need for political action, but perhaps even more pressing is a professional response. We have 3 brilliant speakers. I talked of a stellar lineup. That's what a stellar lineup looks like, ladies and gentlemen. And they're going to help us consider what our response to all of this might be. In a moment, I'm going to ask the Chief Executive of Public Health England, Duncan Selby, and the President of the Royal College of Physicians, Professor Jane Dacre, to respond to a proposal put forward by a man who's advised government ministers on dealing with health inequalities for many years, including heading a review of health inequalities in England for Gordon Brown's government. He is one of this world's foremost experts on the subject, having chaired the World Health Organization's Committee on Social Determinants of Health and been president of the World Medical Association. He is currently Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health at UCL. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Michael Marmot.
I have a PowerPoint presentation with 46 slides, but as it's Thursday afternoon, I decided instead to read from chapter 8 of The Health Gap, a book I just happened to find. In May 2011, Mary hanged herself. She was found in the yard of her grandparents' house on a First Nations reserve in the province of British Columbia in Canada. She was 14. She was a First Nations Aboriginal Canadian. Her story has particulars. All suicides do. She had been physically and emotionally abused in her community and at home. Her mother had mental illness. Officials thought it was some failure of a dysfunctional child welfare system. But there's another way to think about Mary's sadly foreshortened life. And that is to realize that though her personal tragedy is unique, there are many young Aboriginal Canadians who experience similar tragedies. In fact, the Aboriginal youth suicide rate is 5 times the average for young Canadians. We cannot understand Mary without understanding why other young Aboriginal Canadians similarly saw no way out. One way to think about it is poverty. And indeed, First Nation Canadians are the poorest subgroup in North America. As the authors of the study that I quote said They all were living in bone-grinding poverty. There were approximately 200 bands of First Nation Canadians. And in the first 6 years of study, 90% of the suicides occurred in 12% of the bands. And over 20 years of studying this phenomenon, I know you're thinking, perhaps instead of studying it, they might have tried to do something about it. But over 20 years of studying this phenomenon, they looked at which communities were characterized by high suicide rates and which were not. And in my language, the difference was empowerment. They asked, were communities involved in land claims? Did they control their own police and fire service, nursing, medical services, education? The more communities were empowered, having control over their destiny, the lower the youth suicide rate. They had six markers of community empowerment, and the communities that scored high on all six had no youth suicides. Now, I talk about Mary for a number of reasons. When we think about people who are homeless, we think about the socially excluded. First Nation Canadians are socially excluded. Mary's problem was mental health. We have to remember physical health, of course, but mental health as well. It's vital. And I think about Mary in another way, which is when we think about the homeless, it's very obvious. But as some of you will know, I have been emphasizing the social gradient in health. The lower people are in the hierarchy, the higher the risk of physical illness and mental illness. And that's very important because my guess is, I just arrived, so I may be wrong, but my guess is that none of you is homeless. You're trying to improve the lot of people who are homeless because of good feelings, you feel it's your job, it's the right thing to do, a whole set of other things. But there are a lot of people out there who don't care at all. In fact, most people out there don't care at all. It's a bit inconvenient walking, part of my journey here, to walk around the hat on the street. It's a bit of a nuisance, but otherwise, who cares about the homeless? The social gradient in health suggests that we should make common cause between the socially excluded and everybody else. It's not just there, but for the grace of God go I, but the homeless are one end of the spectrum. Take the issue of poverty. Joseph Rowntree figures showed that in 2010, for households with children, 31% were below the minimum income threshold in 2010. In 2013, that 31% below the minimum income threshold had gone up to 39%. Now, most of those 39% are not homeless, but they do have insufficient income to lead a healthy life. So the homelessness is one end of the spectrum. I was in Edinburgh yesterday. I think Scotland really is another country at the moment, the way the discussion. I was at a day-long meeting that NHS Scotland organized on welfare and health. And a GP from Edinburgh talked about a survey they'd done of GPs who were talking about the detrimental effect on patients' mental health. Quote, "I observe this again and again, that I cannot address medical issues as I have to deal with the patient's agenda first, which is getting money to feed and heat." impact on vulnerable young adults, vulnerable families and children. This is a GP talking. We have a working single mother who became homeless due to community violence. She'd been in a cold, damp flat, sleeping on a mattress on the floor with her 11-month-old child for nearly 6 months. Housing has been unable to find her a suitable flat, and so on and so on. Perhaps Jane might respond to this later. I've been trying to get the doctors involved. Currently, for slightly odd reasons that I can neither defend nor explain, I'm president of the World Medical Association. When I say that's odd, because I've spent my whole career saying that the key determinants of health lie outside the medical care system. It's not what doctors do to patients. But here I am, president of the World Medical Association, so I said, I want to get the doctors involved in the social determinants of health and health equity agenda. And we had a meeting of medical associations. The Canadians said, let's do it. And we just ask anybody who wants to come. So it was just the Canadians and the British. And we had 20 countries represented, people clamoring, saying, we want to come, 200 people. We had a dinner at BMA House. And at the end of the first day of this two-day meeting, I was walking up to Euston to catch the tube. And I walked past St. Pancras Church. And people were bedding down for the night on the portico. And my first thought was really stupid. Looked at my watch and said, it's only 9:15. What are people doing going to bed at 9:15? God, how dumb can you be? What else are you going to do? You know, when I go home, if it's 9:15, you think, do I want to work? Do I want to talk to my family? Do I want to relax or eat? You know, you've got choices, lots of things to do that you can do. You don't go to bed at night, but if you've got nothing else to do. So I went back to the doctors the next morning and said, is this any part of your responsibility? Do you just treat these people when they get up out of their sleeping bags and then send them back to the portico at St. Pancras Church? It was very encouraging. It was very encouraging. The doctors overwhelmingly said, this is our responsibility. We really do have to take this on. But tell us, how do we do it? I said to this Edinburgh GP yesterday, you must know what they're doing in Bromley by Bow. Sam Everington tells me that 80% of their prescribing is social prescribing. The way they deal with people with these kinds of problems is social prescribing. So when we were thinking in Edinburgh yesterday, and as I was thinking what I wanted to say to this group, the approach that I take to people who are homeless or socially excluded is the approach that I take in general, which is, if you've got people in front of you who need care, number one is responsibility to deliver that care. But the second thing is to ask, what can we do to prevent the problem? And preventing the problem, and that comes back to Mary, who hanged herself in her grandparents' garden. Preventing the problem is preventing marginality, social exclusion. The reason I mentioned that 39% of households with children are below the minimum income threshold is because we have to make common cause. Those people are not very far away from being homeless. So let me take income, housing, occupation. So let's take income first. Now, I've got something that's a bit rude to say, so anyone who's sensitive, don't, you know, cover your ears. Are you ready for this? Welfare spending is good for health. Where on earth did we get the idea that welfare spending is a bad thing? All a politician has to do these days is get up and say, we've got to get the welfare bill down. And everybody says, yeah. The evidence from right across Europe is the more generous the welfare spending, the better the health, and the narrower the health inequalities. Generous welfare spending is a good thing. That's what the evidence shows. Furthermore, what the evidence shows is the more generous our unemployment benefits, the faster people get back to work. Any economist in the room will tell me that can't be true. They know it can't be true. That's what the data show. The more generous the unemployment benefits of a country, the more rapid is people's return to work. It's because people are not being out of work because they think they're onto a good thing. Almost nobody avoids the workplace because they prefer the alternative of generous benefits. They avoid the workplace because there's no work, or because the economic incentives to get back to work are negative. They lose money by going to work. That doesn't mean we should make benefits less generous. We should deal with the fact that in Britain today, the majority of people who are below the minimum income threshold are in households where at least one adult is working. People are below the poverty line, not because they're feckless or worthless or skiving, or I've forgotten what all the other things you're supposed to call people like that. They're below the poverty line because they're badly paid. So supporting people's income is vital. I was giving evidence to the Scottish Parliament, and one of the members of the Scottish Parliament said, what would you do if you were the Chancellor of the Exchequer? And my response was, I know how lucky I am, but the people of Britain don't know how lucky they am that I am not the Chancellor of the Exchequer. But the first thing is I would put health equity in all policies. I would examine every decision I made for the likely impact on health equity, avoidable inequalities in health. And I said, if my policies were going to increase child poverty, then I would not want to do that, because other things equal, increasing child poverty will make health inequalities worse. And if we compare countries, I said I wasn't going to give you a PowerPoint, I'm just now describing my slides. If we compare countries and we look at child poverty, because child poverty is an antecedent of homelessness. Compare child poverty. Let's compare Latvia and Sweden. And look at child poverty, where child poverty is defined as less than 60% of median income. Let's look at child poverty before and after social transfers, taxes and benefits. In Latvia, child poverty before taxes and transfers was 35%. In Sweden, it was 32%. After taxes and transfers, it had gone from 35% to 25% in Latvia, and in Sweden it had gone from 32% to 12%. In Sweden, they don't like child poverty, so the Minister of Finance uses the fiscal system to reduce it. I wrote a piece recently for Scientific American, and I illustrated what I've just said now by comparing the US with Australia. I thought if I compared it with Sweden, you know, they're all Marxist-Leninists in Sweden, according to the Americans. So I thought Australia sounds a bit like Texas. and that might be a bit more acceptable. And I pointed out that exactly what I'm showing, the Australians use the tax and benefit system to reduce child poverty. And the editor came back and said, I don't quite follow. Firstly, he said, I think we should take it out because I think you're talking about redistribution and Americans will have no truck with that. So just take it out of the article. And I said, no, I think we should leave it in because we're talking about damaging children's lives. So then he said, what are these social transfers? I said, they're benefits paid. So I still don't get it. So then he came back and said, let me see if I understand this. What you're saying is that some people, let's say middle income people, they pay taxes and those taxes are used to improve the living standards of poor people. I said, yeah, absolutely right. Really? Some countries actually do that? He said, yeah, they really do that. I then pointed out to him that in the US, mortality rates for men and women aged 45 to 54, non-Hispanic whites, has been rising. It's been coming down in France and Germany, the UK, Sweden, every country, US blacks, US Hispanics, but for US non-Hispanic whites, it's been rising. And it's been rising because of poisonings due to drugs and alcohol. Are you thinking about the causes of homeless people's problems now? Poisonings due to drugs and alcohol? Suicide? Chronic liver disease due to alcohol? And violent causes of death? And that's affecting the average. The greater the years of education, the smaller the rise, the fewer the years of education, the steeper the rise, so the gradient's getting steeper. And I said, maybe that goes back to investment in early childhood. It's an epidemic of despair, or as I would say, disempowerment. So the first issue is dealing with how much money people have, and the welfare system is quite a good way to make up the gap that the market is failing to meet in terms of people's needs. The second is housing. And I would say that homelessness is the canary in the mine. It's the indicator. If I were going to show you a PowerPoint, I would show you the proportion of housing that's classified as below standard by region in the UK. And the worst off region, it's about 40% below standard. But separating between the privately rentaled, private rentals and social housing. And for every region, the proportion of houses that are inadequate is higher in the privately rental sector than it is in social housing. What have we done? In 1979, 33% of households were in social housing. Now it's just under 17%. It is going to be over now. We will have overpriced, below standard housing, and more people will be on the streets. So it's not just that university graduates can't afford housing in London. It's all the way down the gradient. And more people will be on the streets. So income, housing, occupation. Yesterday in Scotland, somebody from the NHS Scotland, from their health observatory, showed figures of the ratio of applicants to vacancies for different regions in Scotland. And it varied from about 6 applicants to each vacancy to 15 applicants for each vacancy. And increasingly, employment is being segregated into really interesting, fun, well-paid jobs at one end and really poorly paid, uninteresting work fodder, insecure, part-time, 0 hours contract at the other. And it's those same people who are at risk of homelessness. So income, housing, and occupation are all key elements here. Let me say one other thing that's really on my mind, and then I'll make your task easier by stopping. Which is, I was at a meeting last Friday in Turkey on war, migration, and health. And the discussion touched on the fact that some politicians were saying we must not treat migrants or refugees, and the distinction is a bit blurred, migrants or refugees well, because it will only encourage others. And I was talking to doctors, and I said, we've got to take a lead here, a moral lead. In medicine, we treat every individual with dignity, and we treat the individual with dignity responding to their needs. The idea that people should be treated as an instrument of a political process is anathema. It goes against everything we believe. And I would say the same comes to dealing with the excluded in our society. We deal with people as individuals with dignity. I'm an epidemiologist. I'm always looking at averages and causes and social distributions and so on. But each individual has to be treated with dignity, not as an instrument for some other policy. So it's okay to make these people worse off because that way we won't provide incentives for bad behavior. Wrong. Individuals have needs. They need to be treated with dignity. So we need to address the social causes, and we need to treat each individual with dignity. Let me finish by just coming back to the health gap. I wanted to call this book The Organization of Misery. I had been quoting, we launched the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health in Santiago de Chile, and I'd been quoting Pablo Neruda, who said, "Rise up with me against the organization of misery." That's such a wonderful phrase. So I wanted to call my book The Organization of Misery. And the publisher said, "You can't do that. Nobody will buy a book called The Organization of Misery." So I said, "Can I call it The Organization of Hope?" "Better, but a bit obtuse," he said. So, boring title. I called it The Health Gap, but I called the first chapter The Organization of Misery, and documented systematic inequalities in health between countries and within countries. But I called the last chapter The Organization of Hope, because the evidence is that no matter how severe the problem, we can make a difference. Duncan asked me a few minutes ago, "Where's the most exotic place you've been recently?" And I said, "Thailand." And in Thailand, when I was there a few years ago, they talked to me about the triangle that moves the mountain. The triangle that moves the mountain is government, knowledge, including academia, and the people, community. Get that triangle aligned, and colleagues, we can move mountains.